the body of one of the attackers. It was picked up on the runway at the airport. The autopsy categorically excludes an extraterrestrial being. His molecular structure clearly establishes him as a member of the human race.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 202, The Fly 2.
Der Flieger 2.
Excellent pronunciation.
Hey, you know, I know a bit of German here and there.
I know a little German. He's standing over there. I forget what movie that is. I mean,
yeah.
Al Kilmer's in it, and there's a cow on the cover. I forget what it is. Anyway.
Oh, Top Secret?
That's it.
I've not seen that movie. But yeah, no, this is Der Flieger 2, which is The Fly 2, for those that are not initiated into the Deutsch language. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so this is the sequel. This is the 1989 sequel to the 1986 David Cronenberg stone cold classic The Fly, which we discussed many moons ago on this podcast. And The Fly is one of those rare movies that I consider to be pretty much perfect. It's art. Yes, it's horror, but you know, Cronenberg has a way of elevating horror to art, and this was almost like the pinnacle of his filmmaking. I don't know if it's actually my favorite Cronenberg still, Videodrome, but I love Cronenberg. But The Fly was just unbelievable. I mean, you had a director at the top of his game. You had two actors, an actor and a, who were not nascent stars, because they were both, you know, starting to make movies here, but they're in their prime, they were on the rise. Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis, and they had amazing chemistry with each other because they were
involved. Yeah.
Yeah, they were involved. Just amazing script. You had illusion, you had metaphor, you had an incredible visual look to the film. Just brilliant, brilliant movie in every single
way. And yep. I guess we were both kind of dismissive of this as horror snobs, me taking it to the extreme by avoiding it entirely. Oh, it doesn't have the principles involved other than the one guy. I'm not watching this. You being more open, as we talked about in the Chainsaw Massacre sequel. It's like, yeah, dive right in. I was not expecting much here and was pleasantly surprised. This is an entirely different film. And I was in the zone for this one, and mm-hmm. it took me out of my cynicism, and I had a blast.
No, I think the first time I saw it, though, I mean, that's something that happens a lot in horror, where directors won't return. Like, look at all the Jaws sequels that were made and whatnot, and they just pick up and go. Because, I mean, the first one was art, and this was commerce.
Yeah.
Cronenberg didn't want to return. Goldblum didn't want to return. Gina Davis didn't want to return. I don't think they were an item at that point anymore. This is 3 years later. The only returning actor is John Getz, who he's not in this for a whole heck of a lot, and he's wearing a very obvious fake beard, but he plays that, what is the name of his character? I can't remember.
Just like Dr. Keloid, another one of those like incredible, indelible Cronenberg creations.
And he was sort of like the villain of the original one, who then sort of became the hero. So it was good to see John Getz again. And this movie, I think when I first saw it, I was watching it with a bit of a horror snob sort of perspective.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, oh, it's not art. They're just taking what was done so magnificently and turning it into, you know, thrills and that stuff. And the effects aren't as realized and the set design isn't as good. But you know what? At the end of the day, and Eric Stoltz is no Jeff Goldblum and on and on and on. But at the end of the day, revisiting this, I had a blast with it. I think, for totally different reasons, this was just a fun movie. So we have a new movie picking up exactly where the first one left off. Script by Mick Garris. He actually wrote story idea for this and the script. So, yeah, but we're in Bartok Industries. We're back there. And there's a faux Gina Davis. They hired an actress who bears a slight resemblance. I think they even painted a little beauty mark on her cheek. And she's lying there delivering
the goods.
Yeah, she was impregnated by Jeff Goldblum's Brundlefly in the first film, and now she's lying there giving birth. And, of course, she dies in childbirth, and that's a good way of getting her out.
Yeah, yeah. And as well she should, because she birthed this really disgusting pupa baby, and you get just a hammering right over the head and a sense of where this movie is going to diverge from its predecessor right off the get-go. The first one is a very internalized, personal hell that Brundle's going through as he's transforming and decaying, and his body is decaying. Here, we get that too through his son, but it's not to the same extent. This broadens the look and plot to include this greater milieu, which is the Bartok industry. So it's not about one man. It's about how he's like a little pawn in a game that many people are involved in.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting too, because you were mentioning earlier when we were talking about the film, how it inverts Cronenberg's
Inside Out. Stuff, yeah.
Yeah. Like, instead of it being, you know, what's inside is now outside, this is like outside in, because when the pupa is delivered, it's this massive, slimy, grotesque, pulsating
thing, yeah.
And then they start digging, and as they pull away, inside is a fully formed human being.
Yeah, it's a reversal, but not of fortune. It's still bad. It's
a
still
child,
nasty.
A child named Martin, played by Eric Stoltz, and he's born, but unfortunately, I mean, anybody that's born in a pupa is not going to be a healthy child, and he's not a healthy child. He has what's known as Brundle, they actually named after his father, the Brundle Accelerated Growth Syndrome, which means that he's going to age at a very rapid rate. He has an accelerated lifespan. So by the time he's 5 years old,
he's really in his 20s.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a scene when 20-year-old Martin is stripping his girlfriend, played by Daphne Zuniga from Spaceballs and whatnot. I can't remember. What was the name of her character?
Princess Vespa.
No, I'm talking about... Of course, but no, I'm talking about her character in this
Sorry,
one.
Sorry, I love Spaceballs so much.
I know,
if you
do
don't
too.
Give us the combination to the airfield, we are going to give Princess Vespa back her old nose. And then there's like Mel Brooks, like, fucking gag about, like, plastic surgery. I love that.
Beth Logan.
Yeah,
and you know, there's a scene where they're stripping, and it's kind of funny because she's a fully grown woman, and maybe in her early 20s, and he's a 5-year-old kid. But mentally, I don't know.
It does bring in those kind of weird psychosexual elements.
But he doesn't act like a 5-year-old. He acts like a 20-year-old, and he's a genius.
He is. He's been kept in a lab for they're only 5 years, he develops like helmets that he wears with all these different mechanisms. They test him with various a battery of psychological tests. It kind of reminded me, even though I hate this stuff, but I'm going to reference it anyway. He's kind of like a young Sheldon in a way, and that's awful. Big Bang Theory is an awful show. I don't care what anyone says.
I'm just shaking my head right now because
he's a precocious adult in this kid's body, and then he becomes he grows. His growth is accelerated.
Yeah. And he's, they call him Bartok's brat because Bartok takes a very keen interest in him.
He's a father figure to him.
Because for selfish purposes, not because he wants to be the father figure to this kid, but because this kid, if we study him, he can lead to a lot of advancements in the fields of genetics and biomedical technology.
New age represented by machine or whatever it is. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And also he wanted him to, they're trying to work on Brundle's teleportation device and perfect that, and they figure the son could work on it because he's a genius and so on.
Yeah, he's smarter than his dad even.
And they shelter him, and they don't want to give him clearance to certain floors. He does go to a certain floor and he sees something that disturbs him. I guess we can talk about that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Much like, in the first one, I guess Dr. Brundle's trying to, teleport one of our closest relatives with whom we share, I guess, 99% and plus of our DNA, which I think a chimp, if I'm not mistaken,
Because the main thing is they have no problem teleporting inorganic material, but as soon as it's organic, then all shit just,
Yeah, it goes haywire. Let's go to someone as closely, connected to us as humans. So we'll try man's best friend.
Right.
Next,
so in the first movie, tried a monkey, and the monkey turned inside out, and pretty much needs to be destroyed. Yeah. In this case, they use man's best friend. They use a dog. It's a dog that earlier in the film Martin bonded with.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he pet the dog and he told him his feelings and he confided in the dog and then...
Hey, that's pretty sick stuff. I really like what they did with that, because when that thing comes out, it's almost... It's not so much a... like more fly, it was kind of like almost a spider. It was just kind of encased in this
spider
sort of,
and the fly. That's a Who song, anyway.
Yeah, it was enmeshed in some sort of case, and it when it came out, it was like not long for this earth.
Well, it was,
and it is like looking grim.
Well, it was rabid. It was looking grim. They ended up putting it in some sort of facility to study the dog as well. So,
yeah, and it was incredibly touching when the younger Brundle. He chloroforms it and kills his pet, and this thing is like a creature, this really disgusting creature. So this movie is pushing a lot of buttons with dogs and babies, and it's going full bore gore, and good on them for doing that while keeping the spirit of the Frankenstein mad scientist machinations of the first one, or second one if you want to count the Vincent Price one. The one we love.
Well, actually, no. This would be the fourth because there's the fly, this Return of the Fly.
Ah, okay.
And then the fly, Cronenberg, and then the fly two. Return of the Fly with Vincent Price. Little Misfits there for you.
Okay, good.
They have a song called Return of the Fly. Return of the Fly. Anyway, getting back to the seriousness of our discussion.
So, anyhow,
this... Ultimately, he gets tired going in the lab, being monitored all the time. He wants privacy. He wants his own apartment, and he's given one. Bartok gives him his own apartment, and he's
given a job with Bartok Industries as well. So he goes from being like a little lab rat to a guy who they think can exploit and hone the technology. So he's working for Bartok, and he's got his own place.
Yeah, and
good on him. He's 5 years old. He's got a sweet, sweet bachelor pad. You know?
He totally achieved way more in five than I did.
Yeah, exactly.
I was still playing with Fisher-Price building blocks, you know, at the age of five. But anyhow, and he's got a beautiful girlfriend, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the attractive Daphne Zuniga as Beth Logan. But... unfortunately, things aren't going to be on the upswing forever because he starts to mutate. See, I thought the first half of this film, before he started to mutate, I wasn't really digging it that much. I thought that Eric Stoltz, there was no nuance to his performance. He was just, he's no Jeff Goldblum.
No.
But once he started mutating, this film shifted into just... and I'm going to use this in the... see, Roger Ebert used this as a pejorative a lot of times when he would review horror films. He would call it a geek show. It's just a geek show. In other words, there's no artistic merit to it. It's just there to show you disgusting things. This turned into a geek show, but in the best possible way. It just became a monster film, a man in rubber suit running around, causing tremendous carnage. And it was just so much gore, buckets of blood, slime. It was fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah, I guess the only real deficits, again, the chemistry between them is not entirely great. Well, I've talked to, I think, three people now, all of whom really love Jeff Goldblum, and he's got a winking, detached irony that he brings to the proceedings. So even something as goofy and schlocky as Jurassic Park, like there's something about him that he's in on the joke. He's above the material and yet part of the material, and I love that. Like he's such a guy in whom we can be invested, but these two characters here, like your Martin and Beth Logan, they're just really like, she is just a vacant vessel. I mean, she's not a good actress. She was a blank slate as Princess Vespa. She was terrible in like Melrose Place. Like, she's
What's the name of her character? Actually, like Sammy Joe or something.
Oh, I don't know.
Or...
like, she's just
I
like,
forgot
just
that
a,
she went on.
Like, she's just a blank like drywall face. I mean, a beautiful woman, but I mean, she has nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have that spark, that tension. Gina Davis is such a badass. Like, she commands a room, as does he. Like, they're both tall, like, presences. And these... Stoltz is just...
well,
he's too...
the reality is...
Back to the Future kind of Michael J. Fox. Like,
well, you know that he was...
not in a charming
you know way. That he was the original...
I was going to say, yeah.
He was cast originally as Marty McFly. Mm-hmm. But then they realized it just wasn't working out, and they turfed him, and they brought on Michael J. Fox.
Well, he has some of those affectations. He's the bare-faced... like, he's just incredibly boyish. He's bubbly and that. But he just doesn't quite suit
the
role.
And the other thing, too, like, when you look at Goldblum and Davis, we're watching adults, right? here we're watching kids. And I'm not just referring to the fact that he's really only 5 years old, but even Zuniga is probably in her very early 20s.
True.
And the characters of Veronica and Seth Brundle from the first Fly, these were 30-year-olds. You know, so that dynamic wasn't there. But it's okay, because it became a geek show, and it became the most wonderful geek show. It's the most wonderful geek show. It was just, like I said, he starts to mutate, and all propriety gets thrown out the window. This just becomes a monster film. Unparalleled. Love it.
Yeah, I guess as the plot unfurls, we find out that it's not sort of innocuous experiments that he was involved with maybe as a kid, but he's still part of these experiments. He's still being studied and still being exploited and still under their watch. And we find this out in a very provocative scene, which, should we spoil it or maybe not?
I don't know what you're referring to.
I guess you could say that this, speaking to that inside-outside dynamic, there's a kind of a Truman Show element to this, where he was in the lab as a guy living in a lab, and then he's given his own place, ostensibly to live his own life, but he's still in a larger lab. So they are really using him, and they're not disclosing what he has. So he's doing some detective work to figure out.
And actually, they're recording everything, including when he's...
Doing things.
When he was having sex with Beth, and they're using that as leverage because they said he's only five, right? So yeah, I remember that now. Because eventually,
it's all about leverage. It's all about Battlefield Earth. Love our leverage,
right? Because once he finds out that they've been monitoring him and recording him and so on, he starts to go because he's becoming. He's become more fly-like. He has like this wound that starts to fester and. You know, slowly, but then the mutation is slow at first, but then it becomes like his whole body is just encased, and then it just...
It was more, I would say, on the side of the werewolf change than Goldblum, and it speaks to like the capacities of both as actors, but Goldblum had these little ticks and little blurts.
Those were awesome. I love blinks and things little, with his tongue and stuff.
That was so neat, and it wasn't over the top, or it was very subtle, and here it was almost like... So it was like a, you know, like a Teen Wolf kind of thing, where it just, like a Jason Bateman, fresh-faced guy turning hairy.
Teen Wolf 2. T-O-O.
And so I thought that was a little weird. It was more wolf than fly. And maybe it's because he's more pubescent in a way, but I wasn't getting fly elements from him.
Right, but you're not talking about the full-on mutation at the end. You're talking about...
I was talking about as he's transforming. It wasn't as compelling,
but it's
it didn't matter.
Yeah, but it's interesting because... All of a sudden, his acting is so much different, Eric Stoltz. And when he is encased in that sort of wolf-like old man, because it's like a wolf.
Yeah, he sheds some of his hair and he ages.
Yeah, his acting becomes very different. And I'm going to talk about that later on in What Will You Learn. But anyhow, and he starts, you know, like they always get more aggressive. And he goes Brundle apeshit, you know? And he starts destroying his apartment, and then he's running amok. And they got to bring him in. Although Bartok wants him brought in alive because he's still Bartok's Brad. And this is now a fully mutated monster
to his Frankenstein,
And
there, I guess there is a callback to the first one where you have, I guess this is part procedural where the kid is looking into what Papa was up to. He finds this, I forget how he comes across it. He finds VHS footage of
Goldblum,
the elder Seth Brundle, and he's getting the lowdown of what happened to him, so he's starting to see that, you know, he wants a cure and no one's going to give it to him because he's basically being studied in a lab like a chimp that was infected with HIV.
Forget that, I mean, once
like he's just there, like he's being exploited and abused.
Once he's mutated into the fly, but it almost reminds me more like a green pumpkin head, you know?
Yeah.
But once he's mutated, I mean, yeah, like there's no going back. There is a cure. He discovers a cure. Mm-hmm. He can swap DNA. But Stoltz himself, because when he starts off as a good kid with good ethics, and he did some experiments, and he realizes that if he swaps his DNA with somebody else, he will be cured of this affliction. And he mentions it to Beth, but he's like, that would involve making somebody else mutated, and he doesn't want to do that because. But then, when he becomes monstrous, things change in his values. When you're a big green acid spitting, pumpkin head / xenomorph / whatever, you know.
Oh, the acid spitting was absolutely fantastic. So you have like a bunch of interchangeable, disposable Bartok security goons, and they meet their maker in wonderful fashion. So you get this like acidic, you know, sputum, yeah, that just comes out of this creature, and just it's yeah, it's like an acid bath.
Yeah, and it just melts just the face, great. Almost like Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah. It's like, you know, like it was fantastic. You understand, like, the last 20 or so minutes of this movie, when he's going on a rampage,
pure bedlam.
And then even the absolute last scene, which we're not going to talk about because I don't want to spoil certain things, but man, like, it was a roller coaster ride for me. I was like, yes, I love this. I was loving it, everything. And between the acid bath, between the look of the creature, between...
Yeah, it was more the alien denouement and of, than fly. Yeah.
The denouement of certain characters, Bartok, what have you, which that was pretty horrific at the end. But, you know, I was just so on board with it once he started to mutate, and I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Is this a good time to talk about what we've learned?
Yeah, you want to go first?
Definitely. Obviously, how Beth and Martin connect is their co-workers in Bartok Industries. And I just thought this was so hilarious because they are connected and he's trying to show her stuff that he has pass clearance that is much higher than hers. And this was just a great thing where he just has a swipe card, he swipes it, and then she's allowed to just saunter right into the lab. Like, what kind of security clearance is that? The whole point of security clearance is it's just you. And this was like a giant sliding door. And then when he gets in a little spat with her, he says, "Stay out of my sector." And I've never heard that as a line before. It was hilarious. He slides, the door slides in front of her face, and because they have this, you know, little, you know,
battle. One of my favorite lines is when he's a fully mutated creature, and they're trying, the security goons, or not security, this, yeah, the security goons, security guards, whatever, they're trying to contain him, they're trying to take him out, and then at one point, one of them yells, "He's got a security card, because he's this creature, and he's got clearance, he's got access. He can still swipe his card and get into." So that was a great, great line. Is there anything else you learned?
Well, in addition to man's best friend, there's the oft, you know, not well-liked, but equally I like them, cat. So there's a little kitten, and again, they're playing with your emotions, whether it's babies, pets. It's just great, and and against her wishes, I think this is what precipitated the fight, that he puts this little kitten into the transponder. So they're using this, or is that, yeah, transponder is fair enough, right? Or is that transporter?
Transporter, yeah.
Yeah, and that is, I guess, the similar tie-in to the first movie. You have these Italian futurist weird Doctor Who Dalek looking
they had to rebuild those things. They look different from the first one,
slightly,
apparently
enough that, yeah, you know, it was cool, and
because I think they were destroyed after the first movie.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, the
first
telepods
movie, it was filmed in our backyard here in Toronto, and this one also had a Cronenbergian element. I liked the Bartok Industries building. It reminds me of this brutalist building in up in New York University,
right?
But
right,
it's like one of these like 70s just horrific,
I felt the
modernist
same. Yeah.
Buildings, and
yeah,
that's, you couldn't have gotten more Cronenbergian than that.
Like, it was shot in, this one was shot in Vancouver, apparently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, what did you learn?
Oh, sorry. Well, yeah, first of all, one of the things this is another, it almost got like at the end of the movie when it became the geek show, it almost became Stuart Gordon-esque. Like, it really is.
Ooh, I know where you're going. Dr. Pretorius.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, that, yeah.
So just like that, the mutation was phenomenal. First of all, you know, it's in common parlance, Jeff Goldblum's character in the first Fly, Seth Brundle, he's referred to as Brundlefly. When he becomes a fly, he's Brundlefly. And so as I'm like taking notes of this movie, I'm still applying Brundle to Martin because he's Martin Brundle. And I've seen him being referred to as Martinfly. But you know what? To me, he's still Brundlefly. He's like Brundlefly Jr. But Brundle is such a perfect adjective for anyone deformed or mutated. I don't know what it just sounds good. It's like, you know, Brundle Chris. You're now Brundle Chris. Or...
Well, it sounds like a bundle, which is a bunch of things put together. So that probably, I don't know if that was intentional, but who knows? It's just cool name.
You know, because like I wrote down, he's going Brundle apeshit. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then, you know, Brundle Chris, you're now mutated. Or, hey, I'm drinking out of a Brundle cup. What the fuck is wrong with this thing? Oh, you know? God. Brundle floor. It works for everything. So it's Brundle is a great adjective for anything deformed, mutated, or not, as it should be. I'm going to use it now in all of everything I say from now on. It's my new synonym for...
I'll keep a compound eye lookout for that. But, yeah.
The other thing I want to... that I learned is Eric Stoltz was definitely the go-to makeup kid in the 80s. I mean, this was a kid. I don't think it was him in the last third, because, you know, when it was just man in suit walking around. But when he was mutating and he was in case of full makeup, and of course, before this movie, he was most famous for Mask, right?
Yeah, which I
the story of Rocky Dennis with Cher.
Yeah, which I don't think I've seen in its entirety. But my God, the amount of pancake makeup the poor man has gone through.
Because in Mask, he's playing, you know, a kid named Rocky Dennis who was sort of afflicted with what the Elephant Man was afflicted.
Yeah,
and he's got this gigantic, puffy, bulbous head. And it could not have been fun to have your entire head encased in that sort of makeup. And yet, Stoltz did it, and he did it again for this one.
He's a game performer. Totally encased in a pupa, and among other things.
Yeah. So he may not be the best actor, per se, but he's a good sport when it comes to being in makeup, that's for sure.
Definitely, definitely. You know, star rating.
For very different reasons than the first Fly, I'm going to give this one 4 stars.
Oh, my.
Just because it was a rip-roaring good time. And I'm kind of sad that they didn't follow it up with, you know, a Fly 3, the further adventures of... Because, again, I don't want to spoil the ending, but they could have had a sequel, the further adventures of the...
Flying High Again?
Of the Brundle...
Fly 3? Aussie song?
Of the of the Brundle Kinder, you know?
The Flieger Kinder.
The Flieger Kinder.
Well, considering, I mean, it's funny that, you know, John Getz comes back as Stathan Boren. It's just such a great character, and he has... There's obviously no love loss between him and any Brundle, because, as he puts it, and this is one of the great lines in the movie, it cost me an arm and a leg to deal with Brundle, because obviously in the
that
first
was a great one,
his,
yeah, great line.
His acidic expectorant dissolved this guy's extremities, and he's got them all wrapped up, and he's you know, again, he's got some weird fake beard, but his character, he was just so over the top and hilarious. He got all the greatest lines, and this movie had its moments. It was funny, maybe not as gory or as funny as the aforementioned Stuart Gordon projects. Like, when it comes to Frankenstein movies, which this one is, Reanimator is really the apex.
Movies that explore the Frankenstein mythos theme, etc. Yeah, it's not a Frankenstein movie, but yeah.
I think Reanimator is as near perfect a horror film as you can get. So this one, although I guess this was you're referring to maybe the Pretorius from Beyond, where he's got that sort of that similar facial configuration.
And of course, the name Pretorius is directly taken from Frankenstein. Bride of Frankenstein, yeah. Dr. Pretorius. So, yeah.
I'm going to give this, if I didn't know of the existence of the Cronenberg gem,
classic, yeah,
then I would be on board with a 4. So I'm going to give this 3.5. It's a rip-roaring good time. It's a throwback to monster movies of the 50s. Lots of, just wonderful cheesy technology, and I got a kick out of the passwords, because again, the nascent computer, you know, computers coming into their own. It would have been in 89, I guess, barely, IBM coming to the fore as a desktop publisher, and this thing was like, password please, and it's a magic word, and then the lab guys are like, abracadabra? No, it's not that. It's like the password protection.
But that's a magic word.
Yeah. What made me laugh also was when you kickstart.
And what was his password? It was something really basic,
it was very,
daddy or something?
Ooh, spoiler alert. It was a very Star Wars-esque reveal right there. But it was dad. It was, you know.
No, but
it was father.
How's that a spoiler?
Well, that was the password, because I guess, you know.
But dad, his dad, Seth Brundle.
Yeah, I guess so. And also, Bartok could be the father figure, too. So yeah, he was his surrogate father.
Yeah, I don't think that was much of a spoiler at all.
All right, yeah, it doesn't detract from the entire thing. Mm-hmm. But, I'm going to give this a solid 3.5, just rip-roaring fun, and just incredible. And so easy to dismiss, again, because it's a very unheralded sequel. But... in terms of, I'm thinking of, again, something I really didn't like the first time, which was The Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 2. And then revisiting it, I still wasn't quite into it, but I could see so much more of the psychosexual dynamics, and I really appreciate it. That again, time has elapsed, and you're a different person. Your brain, your neural, you know, gray matter has changed. You're like a different everything. And revisiting these movies is such a joy. Because you, like, I'm now an evangelist for this movie against all odds. I was
same here. Yeah,
and that's
I wasn't pretty, before, but I am now.
So you have to see this.
So on that note.
You have to listen to our podcast, too. We're going to try and get it to you every week. Look forward to hearing from you and send us your suggestions, any genre film you'd like. We love musicals. We like post-apocalyptic, beach movies, Elvis movies. You name it, we're behind it. Predominantly horror. Reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.